Okay, team, it's only day 15 of the Trump presidency and we have our first security crisis. POTUS is having dinner at 21, but the guy with the nuclear football is not with him.
There wasn't room for that guy in the POTUS limo. I saw him get into Jared Kushner's limo. But then they changed their minds about 21 and went to Soho to the new Daniel Rose restaurant.
So the guy with the mechanism for a nuclear launch is eating rabbit prepared three ways, 30 minutes from where the president is eating steak.
He could get up there in 20 minutes if he walked over to Canal and took the queue.
The nuclear football is a 45-pound case with, as of last week, Trump embossed in large gold letters. He can't take it on the subway.
Chief, we have a second related problem.
Okay, what?
POTUS is required to carry a laminated card with his authentication codes. We call this the biscuit. POTUS doesn't like the way it breaks the line of his suit, so he had Melania carry it, but she switched purses to that little Judith Lieber bag with the diamonds on it.
So you need the biscuit to operate the football.
That's correct.
And at the moment, POTUS doesn't have either of them.
That's right, Chief.
So we can't nuke anybody for at least 2 hours. Anybody want to get dinner? If we're getting Indian, we're going to Utsav.
I only get udon noodles with gold flakes.
Domino's?
While we figure this out, get ready for some conversations about journalism, being a dissident, and how the nuclear football really works. And now he bought Reince Priebus's Hamilton tickets at face value. Colin McEnroe.
That's the great thing about this whole Hamilton mess, which we're not going to talk about today, by the way. But it is true that, you know, a lot of the Trump senior staff, they're now dumping their Hamilton tickets. They can't go, so maybe you can get them. All right, so you can tell from my voice that I'm not quite myself. And in fact, 2 days after the election, I got really sick, and I haven't been back to work since. This is my first day back at work. And I actually feel a lot better. I experienced a lot of the things that you've been experiencing with like a 104 fever at times, so which tends to sort of double down on the hallucinatory quality of recent events in America. But also it was sort of a good time to, well, it wasn't a good time to do anything. I don't recommend this virus I had. But it was at least a quiet time. It was sort of my own little strange viral bubble in which to sort of watch the stuff unfold and think a little bit about it. I'm not really quite sure that that gives me a better handle on any of the things we're going to talk about today. We are going to talk in just a few minutes about the thing that you heard in that sketch. There really is something called the nuclear football, as you probably know. There also is something called the biscuit, which you might not know. That's the laminated code card that the president has to have on his or her person at all times in order to interface with the football. Anyway, we're going to explain. It's going to be really kind of scary. I'm going to apologize in advance. And we're going to explain how the nuclear launch protocol works and how much control the president has and how hard it would be to stop him. Also, towards the end, we're going to go even darker. Well, not necessarily, but we're going to talk to a journalist who has worked with dissidents in countries where there isn't as much freedom of speech as there is here. And she's going to talk about what you might want to do to prepare if, in fact, your freedom of speech is curtailed. We're not saying it will be. You know, we don't really know what this presidency is going to be like. But we're going to begin by talking about the state of journalism itself. Journalism is in a moment of self-reform and self-reflection. It arises from, at minimum, two things. One of them is that the journalism failed to understand the election very well. Much of what we claimed was possible or not possible turned out to be not the case. And there's also another sense in which journalism, a lot of mainstream journalism, took it upon itself, correctly in my opinion, to warn the American public about some significant deficiencies in the candidacy of Donald Trump and ways in which he departed from even the lowest imaginable norms for a president. And look what happened. So that all makes you sort of think, well, have we been doing our jobs correctly? And if not, how could we do them better? One thing we could do is talk to Margaret Sullivan. She's the Washington Post's media columnist. She's been writing about these very topics. And she's written a very useful piece about three ways the press must cover the Trump presidency in the abnormal days to come. So, Margaret Sullivan, welcome back to our show.
Thank you very much, Colin. Colin, you don't sound so good.
No, actually, I feel This is me feeling really good compared to where I was 10 days ago.
Well, so, I'm glad there's been an improvement.
Yeah, so this is me. I feel like I'm full of vim and vigor, but that's all relative, of course. So let's go through your 3 points. I think they're a very good framework. The first one you talk about is emphasize the watchdog role. Explain what you mean by this.
Well, one of the things that journalism is supposed to do is to hold the powerful accountable. And in this strange time when we feel as though journalism is both under fire for good and not so good reasons, one of the things it can do best is to go to its kind of core role, which is to be the watchdog for public officials, particularly, but certainly for big business, and to do stories that actually represent the public by, you know, following the money, holding what people say up against what they do, comparing what they have said with what they're saying and doing now, all of those sort of accountability things that amount to watchdog journalism, which is kind of the best thing we do after all.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a temptation because of the way this campaign unfolded with these mostly Trump-generated short-term narratives that would kind of pop up mainly on Twitter to get sucked back into this and start reporting about what did or didn't happen from the stage of Hamilton or about New Balance sneakers and stuff like that. And there does seem to be a lot that's worth reporting, starting with the $25 million settlement of the fraud lawsuits against Donald Trump. ProPublica has a terrific kind of guide, timeline type guide to the very best stories that were done about that. But I mean, that's, in a way, that has been a secondary story. There seems to be more focus either on stuff like, you know, as I say, a dust up at the Hamilton performance or this kind of almost pageant like parade of people going in and out of Trump Tower as potential nominees for various things.
Yeah, we seem to be very easily distracted. And I think so is the American public. So, and so is Donald Trump. So it all plays into this kind of attention deficit disorder syndrome that I think we're seeing. But I will say, I do think that the Hamilton situation and the tweets and all of that that's a real story. And as long as it doesn't supersede or knock off the attention paid to the settlements having to do with Trump University or the conflicts of interest having to do with Donald Trump's business interests in places like India and elsewhere in, I guess, 111 countries in the world, potentially, I think it's totally fine to do those stories. But to me, they are kind of extra. They're not the core of what we should be doing the most. So, you know, it's a question of can we do it all? If not, then I think we should absolutely be giving priority to the harder stuff that no one else can do. And, yeah, you know, we saw there really was a lot of great journalism done during the campaign. And some of it, I think, I'm perhaps a little biased here, but I think some of the best of it was done at my very own newspaper, The Washington Post, by David Farenthold. I mean, great reporting. The New York Times did some really good stuff, too. Did it make all the difference? Well, apparently not.
Yeah, I know. Farenthold's been on this show. We, well, like everybody else in journalism, believe that he walks on water now. But there's a terrific story in your newspaper today about something you alluded to, the conflicts of interest abroad, specifically Turkey. You know, I'll quote from the story. Turkey is a nation in crisis, scarred by government crackdowns following a failed coup attempt and on a potential collision course with the West. It also is also home to a valuable revenue stream for the president-elect's business empire, Trump Towers Istanbul. Donald Trump's company has been paid up to $10 million by the Towers developers since 2014. So, I mean, this is kind of an incredible thing. I've been alive for a certain time. I've I remember the Nixon presidency. I remember a lot of things. I don't remember anything like this. And this is hardly an isolated case. There's new reports coming out of Argentina that Trump is actually, in the course of accepting congratulations from the leadership of Argentina, also asking for some help with some permitting process that he needs. Mm-hmm. This is this guy who has this octopus-like empire spreading across the globe, and it interfaces with foreign governments. And he just hasn't really made it clear yet how he's going to operate in such a way as to, for starters, not violate the constitutional prohibition against emoluments.
Right. I think that this is some of the most important work that we're going to have to do over the next months and possibly years is be looking really hard. I mean, one of the expressions about investigative reporting is follow the money, and following the money here will be the key to all of this. And you know, it's a kind of work that not everyone can do. You know, like your average tweet person or blogger or something, can react to this, but can't necessarily do this deep investigation. And this is where the best journalists have to do it and do it to the best of their abilities. So, but there will be plenty of stories to do about it, I guarantee that.
So point two, or thesis two, is represent the interest of all citizens. And you say very specifically that part of the new journalistic imperative is recognizing that those Trump voters who felt angry, humiliated, or invisible may be among those who need our advocacy the most. Say a little bit more about that, Margaret Sullivan.
Well, so, I think at some point a lot of coastal or bi-coastal journalists for legacy news organizations began to feel themselves sort of set up against the kind of person that we saw as the typical Trump voter. And that's not a good situation. Journalists, I think it's not an outrageous statement to say that there are many more liberals among those kinds of journalists than there are, diehard conservatives. And I also think that we didn't do during the campaign as good a job as we should have done in getting to these different parts of the country and really digging in and understanding the fact that people felt left behind by the new sort of globalism and the kind of trade agreements there'd been. So, now in this presidency ahead, we're going to have to really look at how well Donald Trump as president is going to serve the population that elected him. And that's going to be another ongoing story. But we have to get over, if we still have it, the idea that, well, if you voted for Trump, you must have been a misogynist or a racist or a xenophobe or something like that. These are Americans, and they are citizens, and they elected a president, and they deserve our coverage and our empathy and our representation.
Yeah, I can't help but feel that, I mean, this isn't a particularly original, very original criticism, but that, for all of the modern history of journalism, there's been a little bit of a temptation to stick with the story that you've been assigned to. If you're covering a campaign, you're with the campaign. You go to the rallies, maybe you talk to some people at the rallies, and then there are other people working in the background doing some really great digging, like Farenthold. But I'm not sure. I think one of the real failings here was going out to really meet the audience. I'm not saying nobody did it, but I don't think there was this. I think about my own show. We did one show where we brought Trump supporters in here. We invited them in here, and let them talk with a very, very minimal amount of interruption or pushback or correction or whatever. I talked to a guy named Rinker Buck, who is a journalist who, for a separate project, had kind of reconstructed a flatboat of the kind that was used on major river commerce in the early part of the 19th century. And he'd been floating around on this flatboat through steel country and then down part of the Mississippi talking to people. He really had other things to tell me than what I mostly am absorbing from journalism. I knew a guy here in Connecticut who's not a journalist, but he took it upon himself And he moves around a lot. He's not just in Connecticut. He just asked every single person he met for months and months what they thought about the election and wrote it all down. And he emails all of it to me. It's sort of better journalism in some ways than what I'm seeing. I think there's a seduction, particularly of digital culture, to think that you can understand what's going on by reading the tea leaves of social media.
Yeah, and I think combined with polls that were either inadequate in themselves or poorly interpreted. So, you know, there was the kind of insularity combined with bad numbers. That's a bad combination. And that's why I said in a column I wrote on election night that the media had, that it had been an epic fail for the media writ large. If you can say, you know, what, you know, the media is pretty broad brush, but we certainly screwed it up. We certainly led people to believe that Hillary Clinton was probably almost certainly going to win, and it didn't turn out that way, and everybody was surprised, or many, many people were surprised, and that's a failure. That's a journalistic failure.
I think there's another part of this, and you wrote about this in an earlier column, is that journalists at a certain point fell into the same trap as everybody else, which is if you're talking to somebody and they're seeing something that doesn't make sense to you based on the bulk of what you know, what you feel is decided questions, you tend to discount what they say. Mm-hmm. So if you're talking to that Trump supporter and he says, you know, blah, 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 and I know lots of people like me and all the farmers in this county feel that way, you tend to think, well, no, they don't, because I read 538 and I just know certain things,
right.
You know, and you it's like, who are you going to believe, your own lying eyes or Nate Silver?
And I will say that I think Nate Silver got it more right that, you know, among the prognosticators and the poll aggregators, he at least allowed for some 30% probability that Hillary Clinton would win, where others had it much, 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 much smaller than that. So I Nate, you know, tends to be the guy that everybody points to, but I think that he is less at fault than some of the others. But you know, getting back to the idea about going out into these areas and really representing, I think one of the things that happens in journalism is, you know, we do stories. We'll go to coal country. We'll go to, you know, a place that has an abandoned steel mill or something, and we'll do a story. But it has a kind of, you know, foreign correspondent touching down and doing the story and then going back home feel to it. It doesn't really dig in. Or dig deep enough or you know, represent in a full and, you know, fully lived way. And that's a real flaw that I saw, too, was, you know, kind of this outsider looking in aspect to some of these stories that were done.
Last point, be scrupulously fair and relentlessly tough. Probably shouldn't require any explanation. But when you get down to specifics, to a certain degree, it's about how do you describe things that maybe you haven't described before. Steve Bannon is somebody that you cite as posing a kind of challenge. He's a senior counselor in the new Trump White House. He isn't like anybody else who has ever inhabited a position like that before. And so we need language to describe what that means without maybe overloading the language, but also without undervaluing the abnormality of who he is in this position.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, we tend to want to reach for a quick way to remind people of what, you know, in this case, Bannon's associations might be. So we want to use that word. We seem to want to use the word alt-right, but I'm not sure that that really conveys much. And it may be worth taking another sentence or two to really talk about, you know, what this person stands for, what he's done, the kinds of things his news operation Breitbart has, the kinds of audience that it's pulled in, and not just to fall into the trap of a quick phrase, which quickly you start to read over and it's meaningless. So we have to be careful that we don't just get so accustomed to what's going on that we don't continually sort of try to probe a little bit deeper and describe a little bit better.
Margaret Sullivan from The Washington Post, it's always great to talk to you and to listen to what you have to say about the state of journalism. The next time we speak, my normal, honeyed, enchanting tones will have returned.
You will be dulcet once again.
Once again. Thanks for being with us.
You bet. Okay. Bye.
All right. Let's take a little break right now, and we will come back, and we will talk in a way that will somewhat frighten you. There's nothing I can do about that, about how this whole nuclear football thing works. All right, we're back. By the way, it's great to be back. I realize I feel bad for you people. You have to listen to my voice, which sounds like somebody trying to clean out an iron tomb with a rake. But believe me that a week ago, I felt much worse and I sounded much better. So I'll take this exchange, and I'm sorry that I sound the way that I sound. So what do you do when you're homesick and worried about the fate of the country? Well, of course, you got to start, you know, reading very alarming stories about nuclear codes and how they work. I stumbled across a blog called Restricted Data, the Nuclear Secrecy Blog. Alex Wellerstein is joining us now. He's a science historian who specializes in the history of nuclear weapons and nuclear secrecy. So Alex Wellerstein, welcome to this conversation.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So, you know, this is sort of something that people tossed off very casually. Casually is probably the wrong word, but maybe unthinkingly over the course of the campaign. When people wanted to define their sense of concern about Donald Trump, they might say, well, you know, he's going to have the nuclear launch code, or he's going to have his finger on the button, or he's going to, you know, and maybe without thinking too much about that. Now that they do think about it, I think, as you suggest in your blog, that they imagine that it's a system that must have some kinds of baffles and protections in it. That, in fact, even though there's this guy walking very near the president with his 45-pound case, it's not as though the president could just unilaterally send some nuclear missiles or nuclear-tipped missiles into the air. But reading your blog, it sounds like that's the wrong way to think about this.
The entire point of the U.S. nuclear command and control system is to make sure that the president and only the president has that power. And so when you start asking, are there controls against the president doing this, it gets it exactly backwards. The whole fear that was used in setting this system up was that someone other than the president might have that power, and that the president would not be able to do this very easily or quickly. So the system is streamlined so that it is the president primarily who is in charge of the whole thing, and that it can happen extremely rapidly, extremely quickly, without any second guessing.
And if you don't believe Alex, here's Dick Cheney.
The president of the United States now for 50 years is followed at all times, 24 hours a day, by a military aide carrying a football that contains the nuclear codes that he would use and be authorized to use in the event of a nuclear attack on the United States. He could launch a kind of a devastating attack the world's never seen. He doesn't have to check with anybody. He doesn't have to call the Congress. He doesn't have to check with the courts. He has that authority because of the nature of the world we live in.
All right. And by the way, it's not a real football. The reason it's called a football, I think, Alex, is because the operation itself was originally called Operation Dropkick. And if you're going to have a dropkick, you have to have a football.
I've always thought it was a nice also idea about keeping your eye on the ball, right? You keep your eye on the man who's got the nuclear the means of starting nuclear war.
The way I also understand this, there's another element to this. Just to go through the physical aspect of it, there's another element to it, and it is sometimes referred to as the biscuit. The biscuit is some kind of laminated code card that the president has on his person at all times.
Yeah, but the basic idea, and again, not all of this has been discussed openly, so we can only extrapolate on certain points, and I don't have any access to anything classified. But the basic idea is that the football has some sort of computer in it with a satellite link. And what you need to do to initiate the nuclear attack is to authenticate that the person making the order is the president. That's what the authentication is about. It also is going to be labeling which kind of attack plan is going to be going out there, because there's a lot of potential options. So these codes are some means of confirming that, yes, the person ordering this attack is the president. It's not somebody else. It's not somebody who stole the president's jacket or something like that, ideally, right? Mm-hmm. And that the president is also making an order about what's going to happen with these nuclear weapons. This is then broadcast out onto a vastly complicated technical network, organizational network, that is going to make sure that order ends up eventually in the hands of the people who actually launch the individual missiles or drop the actual bombs.
Although we should say, apropos of the jacket being stolen, that according to Hugh Shelton, the biscuit actually was misplaced somehow by Bill Clinton for maybe even a couple of months in 2000, and that when Ronald Reagan was shot, the biscuit, along with everything else, was stripped off his body and thrown into a hospital plastic bag where it was found much later. So these things do, I mean, you know, human beings are human beings, I guess. So one of the things that people started asking you in the comment section of your post, Alex, was, well, I don't know, what about the Secretary of Defense? Isn't there like this thing where the Secretary of Defense has to do? There must be somebody, there must be some other human being in this process somewhere, so that if the president really appeared to be nuts, somebody could do something.
So the way it's supposed to work, and again, this is what's been released, the president is ordering the Secretary of Defense. The Secretary of Defense is then the person who orders the military. The question is, does the Secretary of Defense have the right to veto the president? This turns out to be very hard to document any positive evidence of. The last time that Congress got interested in this question was the 1970s, after Nixon resigned, and there were some rumors going around that he had considered using nuclear weapons in some sort of irrational way. And they got very interested in what they called the veto question. You know, can the Secretary of Defense, can somebody else say, don't do it? It's not clear they can. Constitutionally, again, the president is in charge of the nuclear capability. This is very clear. If you read the doctrine, it is all about tracing back to the president's authority. Can the president fire the Secretary of Defense on the spot? Can the president override the Secretary of Defense? What exactly needs to be put into the football to make these things happen? That hasn't been released. After the 70s, Congress stopped holding any kind of open hearings about this question, and things are pretty much up in the air. I think that it's pretty optimistic to assume that this is going to be some sort of check, because there's everything that has come out is on this subject indicates pretty strongly that the president's will is meant to be the ultimate will on this very question.
Right. And in a way, this derives from a set of values that many of us who might be troubled by the idea of Donald Trump launching nuclear missiles, values that we otherwise hold quite dear, and that's the notion of civilian control of the military. You date this back to in fact, the first use of atomic weapons, the debates that were going on towards the end of World War II when Truman stepped in. Truman, who was not even aware of the existence of the Manhattan Project prior to becoming president, had to make a whole series of decisions. And the military, which was at that point still running a war, also thought it had a lot of decisions it needed to make. And the way that you paint this anyway, if I understand it, is it really has a lot to do with the idea that, no, ultimately Truman's the guy who decides whether we drop an atomic bomb.
In World War II, the major assumption was that the president does not make tactical military decisions, right? They do not go to the president to know whether they should take this city or that city. The president, that's not their role. The place where they start to diverge on this question, and there's conflict during the war between the civilian parts of the executive branch and the military, is over strategic bombing. So originally it's things like firebombing, and eventually this bleeds into the question of atomic bombing. Who's in charge? Is that a military tactic or is that a political activity? And the military mostly carries the day. There is some resistance by the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson. Truman does at times side with him, but it's left pretty much up in the air. It stops being up in the air after the atomic bombs. Truman is on the periphery in that decision. We often talk about it being Truman's decision. It was not Truman's decision. He went along with it, but he did not make decisions over how it was going to be used in any active way. After Nagasaki, Truman seems to sort of be wanting to reassert control. So Truman's major positive order about the bomb was saying, stop dropping atomic bombs. He did that on August 10th. After that point, the language and the issues at play are, who's in charge? Is this an inherently presidential decision, or is it a tactical decision? And without a question, Congress in particular passes laws, and the president picks up the language of the idea that this is really a political question. It is not something you can trust to the generals. Of course, today we are having the issue of, can you trust to the president this decision, which is, of course, not how any of them would have thought of it at the time. And in fact, the whole system, again, is set up with the idea that there's nobody but the president that you can really trust with this decision.
So I guess there are people listening right now who are saying, well, thanks a lot, Colin and Alex. Now you've got me really scared. You're somebody who thinks about this kind of stuff more than the average person does. I don't know. I mean, at the end of your piece, you deal with this question, too. How alarmed should a person be about the notion of somebody with no military background and no real governmental background suddenly being placed in charge of such an awe-inspiring and terrifying decision?
Well, I mean, we don't really know what's going on. I think that's the key point of this whole election and presidency is the uncertainty of it. I would like to believe that faced with this with advice on the danger of these weapons, on the fact that it is really the United States who benefits the most from the maintenance of what they call the nuclear taboo, the decision not to use nuclear weapons after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We are incredibly vulnerable in the way we set up our society and our military to nuclear weapons, and it is really in our best interest that nobody uses them, including ourselves. I would like to believe that rationality would play some kind of role, even without having an outsized faith in rationality in this respect, because there's much in the Cold War to make you doubt that. We do have evidence that when some of the other presidents were told about nuclear weapons, they got a big briefing on the capabilities. A lot of them left shocked and stunned and without any desire to use nuclear weapons at any point. We can hope that that sort of thing would continue on, but I don't know. Personally, I would like to believe, and again, maybe this is wishful thinking, that this is maybe on the list of things one might worry about, but it is not at the top of the list. There are lots of other things. If you were worried, if you were the kind of person who is worried about a Trump presidency, there's a lot of other potential damage that will be done that I think is much more likely to occur. That being said, this is a nice opportunity to think about if you don't trust the worst kind of president with the technology, can you trust the best kind of president with it?
Yeah, no, this has made me think it should be a two-person system. It should be the president and the host of Jeopardy. And if they can't both agree, I mean, it'd be Alex Trebek right now, whoever they pick in the future. If they can't both agree, then we don't launch.
There are ways you can imagine. I mean, we have a system that is optimized to a specific political outcome. Again, the idea that the president will very rapidly be able to order nuclear weapons, and that once that order goes through, it will be minutes until the weapons are launched. And we have optimized it for that function, both because of this faith that the president can manage that decision, and also because you may have to reply very quickly to some sort of crisis. You could imagine a technical system that was optimized to different ends, such as democratic participation or making sure that you're not making a really terrible mistake. There are other ways to do it. Other countries do it a little bit differently. It's the kind of thing that I wish was talked about, but is generally not.
All right, Alex Wellerstein, we talked about it a little bit today anyway. That's progress. I want to thank you again for coming on here. If people want to read more about this, Alex's work is at Restricted Data, the Nuclear Secrecy Blog. By the time you're through reading about this, you're going to hope the singularity happens and the robots take over everything. All right, we're going to come back. We're going to go even darker. Not necessarily, but well, we are going to talk a little bit about what it would be like if, let's say, some of the rights that you take for granted, I don't know, were suspended.
Has his finger on the button, have a lovely night tonight. Hope he's got himself a honey, who knows what to do, and I hope she doesn't.
Trump will be the first president since Harry Truman without a pet, but he has been endorsed by the alt-cat movement. Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. Our executive producer, Katie Tilarski, appeared with us in the intro, and our intern is Grumpy Fisher. The part of Bill Curry was played by the cast of Hamilton. All show episodes are available at WNPR.org/Colin. And on tomorrow's show, why people don't think about voting as much as they think they do. And now, back to Colin.
By which we mean that a lot of decisions that strike you as very rational on your own part and perhaps very irrational on the part of other people are made at a much more quick twitch, fast twitch neurological level. We call it visceral voting. That the people who study this kind of stuff say, you know, a lot of things that people associate with a careful ratiocination are in fact the result of a lot of profoundly visceral, you know, medulla-based decisions that are located in your limbic system instead of up where your conscious thoughts are, which will either, I seem to be incapable of doing anything that's not going to depress people, but I don't mean to. So anyway, well, and it is my first day back from being sick, and I guess the decision we've made is to tell you about some of the worst possibilities. You know, not necessarily with that as a goal. Joining us is Sarah Kendzior, an op-ed columnist for The Globe and Mail. She's a U.S. correspondent, also for the Dutch news outlet The Correspondent, where I wound up reading a piece by her. We're heading into dark times. This is how to be your own light in the age of Trump. So, Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I think maybe I'll just begin by saying that this is an essay about how to function in a situation where some of the norms of democracy don't hold together. And one of the first things you say pretty early in the piece is you're writing this as much for Trump supporters as you are for Trump opponents. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I live in Missouri. I'm surrounded by Trump supporters. I live in now what was a purple state. Now it's a bright red state. And I think that the Trump supporters who I've met at their rallies, at their Tea Party meetings, and just in casual settings as I'm going around, do not know what they've signed up for. I think, you know, obviously there are Trump supporters who are bigoted, who are anti-immigrant, who are at least willing to tolerate those attitudes. But there's also a real desperation out here where I live, an economic desperation that I do think has inspired people to vote for Trump, and they believe that he's someone who's going to bring their jobs back. It's very clear when you look at Trump's cabinet appointees, when you look at the use of his businesses and his family being installed into the administration, when you look at his foreign ties, and when you look at his own proclaimed goals, that his goal is never to help this part of the country or the country in general. He's building a kleptocracy. He's shaking us down like he has in all of his other business deals, you know, from Trump University to Atlantic City to all his other failures. And he's doing that to the nation as a whole. And he's doing it with executive power. You know, I'm also a scholar of authoritarian states. I've been studying countries like Uzbekistan and other former Soviet authoritarian states for over a decade. And what he's doing is very, very similar to what these extremely oppressive countries have done. And as an American, I'm appalled and I'm horrified. And I really hope if you are a representative, or if you're a citizen who listening to this right now, I hope you call your representative. And I hope people take action to review these very anti-constitutional, potentially extremely brutal and undemocratic and economically damaging policies now.
One of the arguments that you make, let me just back up and say that, you know, those people who maybe are not Trump supporters but don't want to drift into a state of alarm too early before even the inauguration has taken place often will sort of comfort themselves with the idea that there is sort of a bulwark of the existing American democracy, that there are just certain processes, conventions, built-in safeguards that can't completely be circumvented, that ultimately the U.S. of A. is the U.S. of A. One of the things that you cite in your article is the argument that you can even trace back to February of 2014. This is Donald Trump talking about Obamacare on Fox News.
You know what solves it? When the economy crashes, when the country goes to total hell, yeah, and everything is a disaster, then you'll have you'll have riots to go back to where we used to be when we were great.
So you'll have riots to go back to where we used to be when we were great. This is something that you, Sarah Kendzior, interpret as a kind of plan, not maybe a plan, but at least a kind of a longing for a scenario so extreme that some of that bulwark that I was just describing disintegrates under the weight of it.
Yes, and it's a scenario that you can see in countries around the world that operate under this authoritarian kleptocracy model. It's politically advantageous for Trump and his family to have the economy collapse, to have extreme social unrest, to use minorities as scapegoats when people are not being economically rewarded or able to sustain their livelihoods in the way they can. His advisor, Steve Bannon, said something very similar, which I cite in the article, that he wants the state to collapse and he wants it to happen quickly. And so, yeah, you know, this is very dangerous. This is a familiar pattern. And I am concerned because the way this works, you know, it's hard to believe this is happening in America because we have our Constitution, we have our checks and balances. We're supposed to have, you know, legislatures and people in office to prevent this from happening. They're not speaking out in the forcefulness that you would expect. And the transition is happening fast. And one thing that I need to say very clearly is that once you get an autocrat into power, it's very hard to remove them. They can rewrite the laws. They can take, for example, a terrorist attack or a disaster to call for a new kind of law or policy. We now have a completely GOP Congress and Senate and president, you know, which makes this easier to do. That said, I'd like to stress this is not a partisan issue. This is something that will hurt Republicans just as much as Democrats. So if you're a Republican, I'd encourage you to read about authoritarian states and read my article and recognize these patterns because it's very damaging. And the foundation of our republic is at stake. And I don't say that lightly at all. I've been studying this my entire career. If you look at other scholars of authoritarian or fascist states, they are all very alarmed. They are all recognizing the whole pattern. And we're coming to terms with this fact that we're more fragile than we thought. You know, obviously, we've had a very hard, like, last 15 years. We've had two wars. We've had a giant recession from which a lot of us haven't recovered. And it's made us extremely vulnerable for an authoritarian demagogue to come in and undermine our liberty, our safety, and our freedom. And we don't have time to sort of see how this plays out. We really need to apply pressure to our officials now to investigate, you know, Trump's corruption, to investigate his tax returns, to investigate his relationship with Russia and other foreign states and his investment in other foreign states, and see whether he has, you know, already broken the law. This is essential. You know, I love this country. I love this country so much. I'm sorry. And I just don't want to see this happen because I've been to countries that are authoritarian states and I've seen that repression of freedom. You know, a lot of us came here to America to escape situations like this. You know, we came here for sanctuary and for safety. And so, you know, I'm very serious that I want everyone to work hard to try to prevent this because the only way I think that's possible is if we really look out for each other and we really work on this together.
So one of the things that you advocate near the beginning of your piece, Sarah Kendzior, and this is a piece in a publication called The Correspondent, it's a Dutch news outlet, is a kind of self-inventory, a conscious moment of literally writing down things about who you are, what you believe, what you could not be persuaded to believe. And I take it this is also from your experience in covering and visiting authoritarian countries where ultimately the individual is pressured maybe to conform with things that range far outside the normal set of beliefs for that individual.
Yes, this happens all the time. And, you know, of course, you know, more familiar examples are things like Nazi Germany, you know, or other fascist states where we look back at that time and we think, you know, how could people have behaved that way? How could people have just stood by and let these atrocities happen? You know, and then you bring that up and you look at life around you now and it seems like pretty normal. It, you know, obviously there's strange things going on in the government, but we know there's not sort of immediate repercussions right now. But it happens very quickly, and part of it is that fear. You know, authoritarianism is not just a matter of the state controlling your rights and limiting your opportunities. It's a way of getting into your head and making your values change, making it seem like things are normal. When institutions are signing on to things that seemed obscene or extreme, and then everyone seems to think that's normal, the media acts like it's normal, citizens do, the government does, then you might think it's normal too. And, you know, there are a few examples of that now, which is that we have white supremacists going into the White House, people who are openly, you know, fans of Hitler going into the White House, people who want to make a Muslim registry that could potentially lead to internment camps, and this is a possibility under existing constitutional law, going into the White House. And, you know, that's deeply frightening. And as I said, you know, you might have this sense of hope and optimism, and believe me, I would love to be wrong, that like, oh, we get to 2018 and we get these guys out. I don't think we have that much time, because once they're in, they tend to stay, you know, and if they leave, it tends to be violent. So I think we need to just be as cautious as possible. I think we need to, you know, take this as seriously as possible and not dismiss it as hyperbole, because if you just read through history or look at contemporary parallels in other authoritarian states, you will see that, you know, unbelievably, the USA, you know, the great democratic place where people go to flee tyranny, is becoming a tyrannical state. And again, I'd like to emphasize this is not partisan. This is not like we, you know, are electing Mitt Romney or something like that. Like, we've got a whole new ball game, and it's important for people to understand the rules.
Well, Sarah Kendzior, thank you so much for joining us. I guess one last thing I would say, you mentioned this in your piece, that one of the reasons that you wrote this particular essay in The Correspondent, which is a Dutch news outlet, is that you don't also have a tremendous amount of confidence that the American press will stay as free as it has been.
No, I don't. I mean, Trump is notorious for threatening to sue, you know, publishers, you know, sending them out of business and partnerships with some of his allies. He has openly threatened journalists. He's encouraged people to attack journalists. Currently, the you know, five major networks are now holed up in Trump Tower, having a completely off-the-record meeting. They gave him more coverage than any candidate in history. CNN's CEO has a framed Trump tweet on the wall. They're very much, I don't know whether out of fear or out of favor, but they're very much in his pocket. I don't have much faith in freedom of the press in the future, you know, which is heartbreaking to me as a writer. And I'm extremely grateful that you had me on the air. And I hope that you're able to keep working. And I hope that I'm able to keep working. And I hope that our country's able to keep working. So, you know, again, I urge your listeners to take this seriously.
All right. Well, Sarah Kendzior, thank you very much for joining us today. You can find her work. It's kind of hard to find, The Correspondent, I think, because it's mainly meant to be in Dutch. But we'll post a link up at WNPR.org/Colin. That's where all of our stuff is. And, you know, I mean, so today, my first day back, maybe we went into some dark places. And if that's not where you want to go, I'm sorry about that. But we're going to go a lot of different places over the weeks and months ahead. And we do want to hear from you, too, about what you think our mission should be. I think, to go back to my conversation with Margaret at the beginning, all of journalism, all of American journalism, is in a time of self-evaluation and in many ways looking at what went wrong in this election cycle. And things absolutely went wrong. I mean, I didn't have a good grasp on what was about to happen, and neither did a whole lot of other people. And that's a bad sign. One thing I will say is I do believe that we need to talk to each other a little bit more, maybe a lot more. My show, like a lot of other shows, needs to begin solving this problem of, you know, how do we meet the audience, maybe even on its own ground? We've tried taking the show on the road a little bit over the last year or so. We'll probably do it even more. I'm not sure Connecticut has all the answers. A lot of the answers lie elsewhere in this country, states that actually went for Trump. But we've all got to keep talking, and we're going to try to do that. All right. Thanks to everybody who helped out today. We'll be back tomorrow with more shows. My voice will get better, I promise. I'm afraid of a man.
lot of people say that they like spring and summer. And of course, fall in New England is amazing. But I don't know, after this show, I feel like my new favorite season is nuclear winter. Or those snowflakes? Ooh, no, those are definitely not snowflakes.